Top stories: Ukraine's President Zelensky renews calls on NATO to impose a no-fly zone over his country, claiming Russia will attack the alliance's members if such a zone is not established. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says its missile strikes on an Israeli center in Iraq's Kurdistan region was in response to the regime's recent crimes. Also ahead, Colombia's front-runner for the May presidential election secures the nomination of the left-wing Historic Pact Coalition in Sunday's primary voting. Day 19 of the Russian offensive in Ukraine, several major cities are witnessing heavy fighting between forces of the two countries. Russian forces have now advanced closer to Kyiv from several directions. In the nearby town of Irpin, a U.S. journalist was killed and another one wounded. Eastward in Mariupol, officials say nearly 2,200 residents have been killed since the start of the conflict. They also say the port city under Russian siege is running out of food and water. More than 400,000 people are also trapped in Mariupol. Russia has opened a new front in western Ukraine, Moscow says. An airstrike near the Polish border has killed up to 180 foreign mercenaries, adding that a large cache of their weapons was also destroyed. The Ukrainian president has warned that Europe that the airstrike meant is the conflict is now spilling over the NATO territory.
And now I repeat again, if you do not close our sky, it is only a matter of time before Russian missiles fall on your territory, on NATO territory, on the homes of the citizens of NATO countries.
Zelensky further said he is seeking to have a meeting with his Russian counterpart. He acknowledged that having such a meeting would be difficult but is required. Earlier, the Ukrainian president said nearly 125,000 people have been evacuated via humanitarian corridors from conflict zones. The corridors were opened earlier this week. According to the UN, nearly 2.7 million people have fled the neighboring country since the conflict began on February the 24th. The number is expected to go up. Robert Carter is in the Polish city of Lubin, near the Ukrainian border. Earlier, we talked to him regarding the latest on the exodus of Ukrainians from their country.
The situation has grown so critical, actually, that Polish local authorities are beginning to issue warnings, both to the Polish government, but also to other European governments, that Poland will soon be in a position where they simply can't cater for any more people. The numbers are continuing to rise. Thousands of Ukrainians continue to cross the border every single day. And obviously, the majority of the efforts, the relief efforts that's taking place inside Poland, is a volunteer relief effort. So it's just ordinary Poles who are coming out, donating food, clothes, water, everything, nappies for babies, for example, as well. Everything you can think of is mostly being donated by civilians and also the volunteers that come out to help greet Ukrainian refugees in. Most of them are volunteers too. So the situation is critical. And obviously, with the fighting that's going on in Ukraine, with the news of these recent strikes that were conducted near the Ukrainian border city of Lviv, that of course has raised considerable concern about the position that Poland is in as well in regards to what's going on militarily inside Ukraine as well. Could Poland be dragged into the situation that's going on in Ukraine? That is a big question on everyone's mind.
Russian and Ukrainian officials have given their most upbeat assessment yet of progress. In their negotiations on the ongoing Russian offensive in Ukraine, the two sides also suggested that there could be positive results within days. Kiev said it was willing to negotiate, but not to surrender or accept any ultimatums. Ukraine also made it clear that it wanted an end to the war and the complete withdrawal of Russian troops from its soil. It noted that the two countries could achieve some results in a matter of days. Meanwhile, Russia said the talks had made substantial progress and will continue on Monday. Separately, the U.S. and Russia are showing said Russia was showing signs of willingness to engage in substantive negotiations on ending the Ukraine conflict. China has denied Western media reports that Moscow had asked Beijing for weapons since launching its military operation in Ukraine. China said its priority is to prevent the tense situation in Ukraine from getting out of control. The Financial Times and the Washington Post had reported on Sunday that Russia had been seeking military equipment from China following its attack on Ukraine. Meanwhile, Washington warned Beijing that it would face the consequences if it helped Russia evade sweeping sanctions imposed on the country. The U.S. had also said it would not allow any country to provide a lifeline for Russia with sanctions busting. The White House imposed sweeping sanctions on the Kremlin in the wake of Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Iran's top security official highlights the balance between field and diplomacy in his country's policy, alluding to them as two components of the Islamic Republic's power. In a tweet, Ali Shamkhani said Iran uses both field and diplomacy proportionately and wisely to safeguard its security and national interests. He said over 40 years of experience has taught Iranians that relying on Western or Eastern powers would not guarantee their rights and securities. Shamkhani's remark came hours after Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps carried out a strike on a strategic Israeli center in the Iraqi city of Erbil.
Massive explosions lit up the night sky over Erbil, the capital of Iraq's northern Kurdistan region, in the early hours of Sunday. Initial reports pointed to the detonation of as many as 12 ballistic missiles. Then a statement came from Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. The force said it had fired powerful and precision strike missiles targeting a strategic Israeli center for conspiracy and villainy. The IRGC said the attack follows Israel's recent crimes and promised that those atrocities would not go unanswered. The IRGC warned that further Israeli acts of aggression would receive a tough, decisive, and destructive response. Israel has long been blamed for a wide range of anti-Iran measures, including acts of sabotage against its nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iranian scientists. Former Israeli officials have also confirmed the regime's role in the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani in Iraq in 2020. And just last week, two IRGC officers were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the Syrian capital, Damascus. At the time, the IRGC vowed that Israel would pay for the crime. In 2018, Israel killed a number of Iranians during an attack on an airbase near the city of Homs in western Syria. Iran later retaliated with a barrage of missiles targeting Israeli military positions in the occupied Golan Heights. The missile strike on Erbil could be seen in the same light. Iraq's Kurdistan regional government officials have denied the presence of Israeli bases in Erbil, but the two sides enjoy friendly ties. Back in 2014, Israel bought Kurdish oil despite opposition from the central Iraqi government and threats to take legal action. 3 years later, Israel endorsed an independence referendum carried out in the Kurdistan region. And last year, Erbil hosted a conference on normalization of ties between Iraq and Israel, prompting a furore. The Kurdish regional government said it was not aware of the conference being organized. Some analysts believe Israel is pursuing several objectives in the Iraqi region.
Of course, they can also foment sectarianism in places like Iraq, you know, picking on individual weaknesses of people with the finances of the Americans or others. They can create, you know, all sorts of divisions and hatred to create problems within these nations. And their primary purpose is really to encircle the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is the only nation and the most powerful nation that stands up for the oppressed in that region. And the primary oppressor in that region, of course, is Israel.
The IRGC says Iran's peace and security is a red line for Iranian armed forces, and they will not allow any harm to come to the country. Words that will now sound even more reassuring to the nation and forbidding to its enemies.
A United Nations report says Israeli forces have killed 8 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank in just over the past 2 weeks. According to the bi-weekly report from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the killings by the regime's forces took place between February the 22nd and March the 9th. A 13-year-old boy was the first Palestinian victim in the West Bank city of Bethlehem. That followed by the killing of other teenagers in the same area, and in the latest, a young Palestinian man succumbed to wounds he sustained during an Israeli raid in Nablus. According to the report, Israeli forces have also injured 140 others and demolished around 30 Palestinian homes in the occupied territories during the same period. Author and journalist Robert Fantina says Israeli atrocities against Palestinians are marginalized in Western media, whose focus was thoroughly on the ongoing Ukraine crisis.
This is shocking, but it's business as usual for the Western media and most of the governments, Western governments. This is racist, certainly. There have been newscasters in the last few days. We're talking about Ukrainian refugees and saying how they are white, European, Christian. And this is apparently what's important to them. The fact that the suffering Palestinians are Muslim and they're from a Middle Eastern country rather than from a European country is apparently significant for some unknown reason. But this is racism and hypocrisy in its truest forms, and it's shocking and needs to end. The people in Palestine are suffering and have been, as you mentioned, for 70 years, and their suffering needs to end. We all want the conflict in Russia and Ukraine to end, but we also want the conflict in Palestine to end, and in Kashmir and other places.
Saudi Arabia has executed 81 people over alleged terrorism-related charges in one day. The Saturday executions have drawn widespread condemnation. Iran called the executions an inhumane act and that violated basic human rights principles and international law. Iran also slammed the Western countries for their double standards and the instrumental use of human rights against independent governments. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement slammed the killings as a heinous crime. It said Riyadh practices the ugliest forms of sectarian discrimination. The Yemeni Committee for Prisoners of War warned of serious consequences for the Al Saud regime. Reports say over 40 of those executed were from the Shia-majority region of Qatif. This is Saudi Arabia's highest number of recorded executions in one day. Among them were members of Yemen's Ansarullah movement. Political commentator Faraz Al-Najim says Saudi Arabia's execution drive shows the kingdom is depriving its own citizens of their basic rights, including the right to have fair trial.
It's unfortunate that the Western world is very silent and they're watching all these human rights violations happening. And they know very well that the Saudi claims are all, they're illegitimate. They have no real credibility to them. And they use any type of pretext to, silence anybody or imprison anybody. And at the same time, these prisoners don't even have basic rights to, for instance, even get a lawyer to represent them. Nothing is published on the media about what they're fighting for, how they're defending themselves, what the case is really all about. And like you said, some of these people were minors when they were arrested. Obviously, they were just peacefully protesting against the Saudi regime because of the way they treat the Shia minority inside the country. And it's well documented, well known that the Shias are, you know, always mistreated in Saudi Arabia. And this continues to happen. The Saudi regime has no respect for human rights, does not have respect for any human rights organizations. We can see there's no human rights organizations that are allowed inside Saudi Arabia. No organizations are allowed to operate, to do any research, to do any investigations. Nothing is allowed in Saudi Arabia.
South Korea's president-elect Yoon Suk-yeol has outlined his priorities. Top on the list is tightening the alliance with Washington, strengthening the military, and implementing a hardline policy on North Korea. Frank Smith is in Seoul.
South Korea elected a new president Wednesday as conservative People Power Party candidate Yoon Suk-yeol defeated progressive Lee Jae-myung by less than 1% after all the votes were tallied. Yoon was quick to outline the hard line he will take with North Korea.
In order to protect the safety of our people, property, territory, and sovereignty, we will build a strong military capacity that can reliably suppress any provocation. I'll firmly deal with illicit, unreasonable behavior by North Korea in a principled manner, though I'll always leave the door for South-North talks open.
North Korea conducted several missile tests in the weeks leading up to the election. Some analysts believe President-elect Yoon, a former prosecutor entering politics for the first time, will face some early challenges from Pyongyang.
The Conservative Party has been very critical of the government's position on military exercises. Of course, South Korea will come out with a new North Korea policy, but North Korea will also conduct a couple of activities to test the Yoon administration. I'm not sure whether this will lead to conflict or dialogue.
The Moon Jae-in administration had sought engagement with North Korea, but its policies were often stymied by a hardline U.S. approach. Yoon Suk-yeol's foreign policy marks a stark turnaround from outgoing President Moon Jae-in, particularly concerning North Korea. Yoon advocates the deployment of a second U.S. anti-ballistic missile battery to protect the capital, Seoul, the resumption of joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises, and the preparation for South Korea's military to execute a preemptive strike on North Korea should Pyongyang pose an imminent threat. In addition to the difficult North Korea issue, President-elect Yoon will have to deal with a raft of domestic problems, including a housing price bubble and income gap, a surge in COVID-19, as well as rising inflation. Frank Smith, Seoul.
That's the world news for now. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon reached a record high for the month of February, jumping by nearly two-thirds over last February's level, according to official data released recently. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jenna McGuire, writer. This article is published under the heading, Amazon Deforestation Hit Record High in February, up 62% from 2021. Here's the story. Deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon reached a record high for the month of February, jumping by nearly two-thirds over last February's level, according to official data released recently. Satellite images released by the Brazilian space agency INPE's Deter Monitoring Program show 199 square kilometers, about 77 square miles, of the Amazon rainforest was lost to deforestation last month, the highest rate recorded in February since the agency began keeping records in 2015, and 62% increase from last year during the same month. Environmentalists find the data particularly alarming since February is considered the rainy season in the Amazon and generally sees the lowest rates of deforestation throughout the year. As indigenous communities and global environmentalists have been sounding the alarm on the imperiled rainforest, deforestation has skyrocketed under Brazil's right-wing president Jair Bolsonaro. While the Amazon covers land in nine countries, approximately 60% of the forests lies in Brazil, which has reached its highest level of deforestation in more than a decade. This absurd increase shows the lack of policies to combat deforestation and environmental crimes in the Amazon driven by the current administration. The destruction just isn't stopping, said Romelo Batista of Greenpeace Brazil in a statement. Deforestation is predominantly caused by animal agriculture, soy production, logging, mining, and major construction, and has greatly impacted the nearly 1 million indigenous people from over 300 tribes who live in the Brazilian Amazon. We are going to be eating the rainforest in our burgers, Holly Gibbs, a land use scientist at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, told the Washington Post, adding, "This is our moment as Americans to step forward and leverage some pressure to save the world by helping to save the Amazon, which is critically important for the future of our planet." And research published recently in the journal Nature Climate Change found that the world's largest rainforest was quickly reaching its tipping point, and that the Amazon has been losing resilience since the early 2000s, risking dieback with profound implications for biodiversity, carbon storage, and climate change at a global scale.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone.
Let us listen to a mind-stimulating saying from the Holy Prophet's seventh infallible successor, Imam Musa Kazem, peace be upon him. The light of the body is in the eyes. If the sight is luminous, the whole body will be bright. The light of the spirit is in the brain. If a person is really intelligent, he will acknowledge his Lord. If he acknowledges his Lord, he will clearly see his religion. If he ignores the affairs of his Lord, he will be having no religion. Like the body that does not live without a living soul, the religion does not live without true conviction. True conviction is proved only through the mind.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from a series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. Dear brothers and sisters, if you have been following these series of shows, we are trying to answer the doubts and misconceptions on the Islamic beliefs which are received usually in the form of questions from different questioners from around the world. The question of the day is about the validity of some narrations and a hadith. Dear Sheikh, it has been asked that it's true that we almost 14 centuries have passed from Islam, and we are talking about narrations and a hadith that has been narrated from Imams and the Prophet. So how can we trust all these hadith and narrations after this long period of time? And you see, when we are going to narrate a part of history from 30 years ago, we have different forms of narrations of the same event, which has not even passed a long time from that, and even our fathers or grandfathers have yet witnessed those events. But we are talking about the hadith that came to us from 14th century ago. Are they validated, and can they be trusted to actually tune our lives based on them? This is a question that has been asked by a respected questioner.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You see that about the authenticity or validity of the narrations that we have a lot of hadith corpuses and different collections of ahadith in different and various books of Shia school of thought, or for example, Sunni school of thought. We cannot ignore this huge heritage, Islamic heritage. You see that talking about the ahadith and narrations, whether from the noble Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessing of Allah be upon him, or his pure progeny, or for example, for the Sunni school of thought about the companions of the noble Prophet or Tabi'in, we have a lot of numerous, hadith corpus collected these Islamic heritage.
Yeah.
Of course, these ahadith before the verses of Noble Quran, they are some source for understanding Islamic learnings and Islamic teachings. And of course, we have beside that wisdom and the consensus. But after all, these Quran and hadith are two and main parts of the Islamic sources. You see that for checking the authenticity of narrations, of course, we have Ilm al-Rijal.
Yeah.
You see, Ilm al-Rijal talking about the single narrators of the, you know, talking about the chain of the narrations. For example, Dhurara from Muhammad ibn Muslim, Muhammad ibn Muslim from other narration, from other narrators, and so until it reached to the Ma'asum, infallible Ahlul Bayt, or for example, according to the Sunni school of thought, to the companions of the Noble Prophet or Noble Prophet himself. For example, we have Qurb al-Isnad for some of the hadith corpus. These Qurb al-Isnad, mostly we have, for example, three or less narrators. Till the infallible Ahlul Bayt. Mm-hmm. You know how close this Qurb al-Isnad is to the infallible Ahlul Bayt. Of course, we have different ahadith or different chain of the narrations till the until it reaches to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam themselves. Yeah. You see that about this ahadith, this Ilm al-Rijal, as I said, and because it is very important, I just want to repeat myself.
Yeah.
This Ilm al-Rijal checked single narrators of that specific narrations. Yeah. Whether that person, for example, was authentic one or liar, whether that person was, you know, was able to quote the exact version of narration or not, which we call it dhabt.
Yeah.
Whether that person was, you know, has this ability to remember that and to have the ability of tahammul al hadith, which means to have and to memorize this narration and to pass it on to another, you know, narrator or not.
Yeah.
And beside this ilm al rijal, we have ilm al diraya. Ilm al diraya talking about, again, chain of the narration, entire chain of the narration.
Mm-hmm.
Whether this narration is sahih, muwathaq, hasan, da'if, mursalat, different kinds of the, I'm not able to explain all the, explanation for the ahadith. For example, which hadith is authentic or sahih? Which hadith is considered to be weak? Because we have different, bases for that, you know, and different presupposition for whether this hadith is considered to be muwathaq or not. And what is the definition of muwathaq? What is the definition of hasan, mursala, maqtu'a, muzmara, and so on and so forth. Numerous explanation for ahadith. This is a responsibility of ilm al-diraya. And after that, this diraya checks the contents of the narration and then goes to the tahammul al-hadith, which means the ability to quote the narration, okay? And adab naql al-hadith, which means the, you know, etiquette for quoting the narration. I just want to emphasize on the point that our dear questioner was not informed about the different sciences for hadith.
Yeah.
Hadith sciences. Mm-hmm. Because these sciences talks about the authenticity of the narration and the content of narration in a way to the extent that we become 100% sure that particular narration is authentic or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is no shadow of doubt that particular narration is authentic or not.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Inshallah, inshallah, inshallah.
And how come about what the comparison that this person is making that says, for example, a part of history or event that happened 30 years ago, and there are different narrations of the same event, see? So which one is the most reliable narration of the same event is something that sometimes the people get stuck with that. So how can we tell this brother that the knowledge of hadith differs with the knowledge of, let's say, narration of the history of the, let's say, modern or even old time?
Even for the history that you mentioned, we have some ways for understanding that whether that's part of that history is authentic or not. For example, talking about the history of the Karbala or the what's happened in the land of Karbala about the day of Ashura and before that and after that, we have numerous books which has been quoted the story of Karbala about the massacre in that land. Okay, in a way that we become sure that because it has been quoted frequently, which we call it mutawatir, it has been frequently quoted, we become sure that that particular event has been, occurred in that time. Okay, and of course, in the historical point, we have a lot of example for that, in a way that we become 100% sure that that particular event was occurred. Okay. I want to say that in different, for example, in history, we have some ways for understanding of that. In hadith, we have different academic way, wise and acceptable way for checking the authenticity of that narration.
You pinpointed some of the knowledges of hadith, like that of Rijal and the knowledge of knowing the validity and reliability of a hadith, and you talk about different forms of. Can you please briefly introduce these knowledges to get informed that okay, there is some series of, let's say, processes that happens on a certain, let's say, word or let's say hadith that comes from the Holy Prophet to reach us. So it's not that easy to say, okay, this hadith is mutawatir, is accepted, and the other hadith is rejected. So this is not something that can easily be done. So it goes through a, let's say, lengthy process to reach the conclusion.
Exactly. When you want to check authenticity of one narration, I remember that in the, some scholar, they spend maybe some weeks for checking the authenticity of one narration.
Yeah.
Whether this narration is authentic or not, okay? True. They check single by single narrator of that, the chain of that narrator, okay? And they went to the biography of that narrator. And they check even the, for example, descendant and the parents of that narrator. I mean, all things which are relevant to that narrator, which we call it Ravi, in order to check whether that particular man was authentic one, can we rely on his saying or not? I mean, it's not easy task. We should spend a lot of time and energy in order to understand whether this narration comes back to the, an infallible individual or not.
Okay.
And this, I mentioned that this is a branch of science. Maybe knowledge, maybe we call it, ulum hadith. And of course, here in Qom, at least, we know some of the institutions that are working on ulum hadith and the sciences related to hadith.
Yeah.
As I said, it has three branches at least. First of all, dirayatul hadith. I explain what does it mean, understanding the narrations. It has an explanation to that. And after that, rijalul hadith, talking about the narrators and the chain of the narration. And then we have Rivayatul Hadith, how to quote the narration, what is the etiquette of that, and so on and so forth.
Very true.
I want to say that if you want to become an expert and to understand whether this narration is authentic or not, it requires a lot of study.
So, supposedly, a hadith has been scrutinized by the experts of hadith, for example, belonging to a denomination, let's say the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt, is the outcome and output of this group valid and also trustworthy for the other denominations to refer to? That is, whatever comes an output of, let's say, hadith sahiha or correct hadith or let's say reliable hadith, an authentic hadith. So can it be also accepted by other Islamic denominations or only valid for the followers of the same sect?
Of course, basis and mabani, which we call it basis, for checking the authenticity of ahadith are different. As I mentioned in the beginning of this episode, we have, for example, in Shia school of thought, it has some scholars has been mentioned numerous ways and signs for the authenticity of the narrations.
Yeah.
And maybe these narrations and these signs are different from the Ahlul Sunnah. Of course, for sure, to some extent, we have some differences. And these differences in basis, the outcome of that is, you see that there are different, maybe, for example, whatever is acceptable from Shia school of thought, maybe it's not acceptable from the Sunni school of thought, and vice versa could be, possible. But after all, we have lots of commonality in, even in the hadith sciences, we have a lot of commonality with the Sunni school of thought.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for your explanations and scholarly answers to the questions that were posed here in this show. Till our next show, I'll leave you in Allah's protection. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن، إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن، لعلي وحسين وحسن. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Local fishermen have rescued an injured baby manatee on a bay in far southeastern Cuba. The fishermen are nursing the injured baby manatee with cow and goat milk mixed with coconut water. They discovered the injured manatee with gashes on his head and body in Maria del Portillo Bay near Havana. Upon arrival on shore, the fishermen recruited volunteers for a nearby farming village.
We were fishing along the shore when we saw the manatee coming. When it approached us, we realized it was injured. It had several wounds on its body, one on the head and two on the rest of the body. Between the two of us, we made the decision to take her to the port of Maria del Portillo, where the boats were moored. When we got there, the whole town was very surprised. Some people ran to help us, others ran to get milk. Seeing that it was small and knowing that it's a mammal, we decided to give it some milk. The people who have cows gave us cow's milk. Those who have goats gave us goat's milk.
Manatees are aquatic mammals akin to giant water-borne cow. The mammal is found in sheltered bays and estuaries throughout Cuba. Scientists say coastal communities could play a key role in protecting marine species and their habitats. Races, beauty contests, and a marvelous show. Here is everything you need to know about the first Qatar Camel Festival. Qatar kicked off its very first edition of the Camel Festival earlier this month at Lapsire, Doha. The festival features unique and high-value breeds for the public to enjoy. Camels from all around the region will also get to flaunt their posture to earn the title of the most beautiful camel or the highest value breed in the festival. But first, the whole lot should be judged.
Judging is based on the size of the camel's head, the length of the neck and the beautiful appearance of the animal and its health status. Of course, judging is different for each group of camels. For example, in the case of camels that are black, the focus is on the size of the animal's head. But on camels that are white, the focus is on the beauty of the camel and the harmony of the body and the beauty of the animal. In addition, we have very experienced professional staff who will deal with the animal if it is artificially beautified.
To spike excitement and competitiveness in those who enjoy such shows, the country has allocated a whopping 47 million Qatari riyals for the lucky winners. The 45-day event will last until March 22nd and will include various competitions, including 115 local and international races.
In the streets of the Chadian capital city, an actor is bringing culture to impoverished neighborhoods by organizing readings of poetry and plays.
Culture should be accessible to all. If we want to have a wonderful world, a harmonious world, everyone should be focused on the same dimensions to be able to dream together. And without culture, we don't be able to initiate development. And to initiate this stage of development, we need to invite people to think together.
The actor does not have a fixed place to tell his stories. He performs in public spaces and says it is his way of giving everyone the opportunity to discover and explore creativity. Among the activities Bonaventure organizes, one can name drawing with children and conducting acting classes. He believes music and theater bring other disciplines together, creating an avenue for enriching human connections. Residents, especially the children of the impoverished neighborhood, say they always look forward to Bonaventure's arrival. A first-of-its-kind selfie museum in the Central American country of Guatemala is gaining lots of attention from excited enthusiasts. The selfie museum is located in Antigua, Guatemala, and is made up of 40 rooms or scenarios. Each room is a recreation of a colorful theme. Wallpaper, wings, greenery, neon signs, and other props are all present to spark the interest of visitors. One room includes a levitating bed, and another is equipped with a spaceship. Other rooms have familiar scenarios of presidential offices and comic book characters for visitors to take photographs in. Several artists participated in creating the art illustrations. A zoo in Peru's capital city, Lima, is celebrating a rare hatching of endangered baby crocodiles. The Huachipa Zoo showcased three females and one male to the public on the World Wildlife Day. The four crocodiles were born in incubators as part of the conservation efforts for the reptile. This species is an American crocodile, which is on the endangered list of animals in Peru. Zookeepers say the black market and threats on their habitat have seen the crocodile population dwindle. The zoo regularly receives animals that were rescued from trafficking. Among those traits are tortoises, macaws, and monkeys.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Thank you.
The 2022 World Cup is reaching a fever pitch as hundreds of people line up at a shopping center in Qatar to take a picture with a trophy. The famous Golden World Cup trophy was unveiled during a ceremony at a mall in Doha, where excited football fans waited for their turn to see it. They were also given the option to take a selfie or have their photo taken professionally. While the competition is still nearly a year away, FIFA says more than a million tickets were requested within the first 24 hours after sales opened. The highest demand came from fans from Qatar, followed by Argentina, Mexico and the United States, among others. Bangladesh is reviving the ancient tradition of producing a historically renowned fine hand-woven fabric called muslin. With the help of the government, the trade is making a comeback. Now, a workshop has been set up in Dhaka where weavers are being trained in the ancient art. They say it took them months to master the craft, working with incredibly fine hand-spun cotton yarns. The weavers say it takes them 8 hours to spin just 4 centimeters. Some varieties of the fabric are so fine that an entire muslin sari could fit inside a single matchbox.
There was a myth about muslin that it was so delicate that it would pass through even a small ring. Look, it's true. There is space to squeeze in another piece of cloth through this ring as well.
Breathing life back into this ancient trade was not easy. Officials with a revival project say there was little knowledge about how this fabric was made. Plus, the rare cotton variant, which makes this fabric so expensive, was also lost. The precious fabric was the most extravagant of its era and popular in Mughal courts. It was also imported into Europe for much of the 17th century and transformed the style of the aristocracy there.
An art gallery in London, Tate Modern, is hosting an exhibition with a remarkable span of surrealist works. The exhibition, dubbed Surrealism Beyond Borders, features more than 170 artworks ranging from paintings and sculptures to photography and films. Works by more than 150 artists from over 60 years are on the display. The exhibit also has a wide geographical span and includes surrealist artworks from different countries. Some of the most prominent artists whose works are being exhibited include Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, and Ted Jones. The exhibition will run until August 9th. Impressive, creative, wonderful. That's how visitors describe the works of Vincent Hoch, a Dutch post-impressionist painter being displayed in an impressive art exhibition in the Argentine capital. Hundreds of Van Hoch's paintings are projected onto the walls of the gallery. The image bloom and ripple in front of the audience, creating a 3D-like and immersive experience. Van Gogh was one of the most famous and influential figures in Western art history of the 19th century. He is largely remembered for his impressionist style, a break from the old traditional art technique. He is also famous for his turbulent life, which was made for outlandish, emotionally charged paintings.
Students and staff gather for sizzling meat sandwiches as they signal their orders with their hands at a food truck in Pakistan's capital city of Islamabad. The Abbe Cow is no ordinary food truck parked on the campus of the Millennium Universal College. It is fully managed and run by staff with hearing impairments. At the beginning of the queue, a diagram shows simple phrases in sign language which customers use to order their food and communicate. The food truck is Pakistan's first mobile restaurant entirely staffed by deaf workers, providing an economic opportunity for them.
Having the startup here at our campus has been really fruitful. Not only have we created more awareness around the sign language amongst our students, but we've also created an inspiration for TMUC students to look up and pursue entrepreneurship as a career choice.
The project developer, Aisha Raza, says the majority of deaf youth end up unemployed and face inequality and discrimination. She says she wanted to create an opportunity for her brothers to economically thrive. The goal is to bridge communication gaps between the deaf and hearing communities and help remove language barriers. The food truck is the brainchild of a family where both parents and their sons are either totally or partially deaf.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the occupied Golan Heights, the population of settlers and Syrians is approximately equal. But experts fear that a new Israeli regime project will turn Syrians into a demographic minority on their own land, says Jessica Boxbaum, journalist, in an article titled Zionist regime is tightening its grip on Syria's Golan Heights by creating facts on the ground. Stay tuned for more. On December 15, 1981, the Knesset, the Zionist regime parliament, enacted a law officially annexing the Golan Heights, Syrian territory captured by the Zionist regime during 1967 Six-Day War. Now, 40 years later, the Zionist regime hopes to double the size of Jewish settlements there by the end of this decade in an effort human rights activists see as further normalizing a forgotten occupation. Last month, the Zionist regime approved a $300 million plan to promote Jewish settlement expansion in the occupied Golan Heights. In response, Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in the Occupied Territories, and Al-Marsad, the Arab Human Rights Center in Golan Heights, submitted a letter to Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit and the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett this month, demanding the plan's cancellation, given that it is a violation of international law to build settlement on occupied land. Attempts to normalize the occupation of the Syrian Golan have no validity in international law, and the status of the Golan Heights remains occupied territory, Adala attorney Sohad Bashara said in a press release. The Zionist regime has yet to respond to the organization's letter. Currently, about 28,000 settlers reside in 34 settlements in the Golan. They operate 167 settlement businesses and control 95% of the land. The new initiative seeks to double the settler population in the Golan in 5 years by establishing two new settlements and relocating or building factories in the region. The aim is to add 23,000 settlers and construct 7,300 housing units. It also wants to boost the population of Katzrin, the largest settlement in the Golan, by 50,000 residents by 2040. The expansion of settlements in the Golan Heights not only violates the rules of international humanitarian law and human rights law, but also deepens the discriminatory reality against the natives concerning their rights to use natural resources, Al-Marsad attorney Karama Abu Saleh said, adding, this exacerbates the situation whereby settlers have privileges in receiving budgets and access to natural resources, while the natives are suffering from land shortages and other crises. In 2019, then-President Donald Trump signed a proclamation declaring the Golan Heights as part